its current state on WKAR 90.5 FM, and it's Friday. Thank you for being here. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Jake Neer, who joined us yesterday to talk about Governor Snyder's deposition with union attorneys, reports this morning that the governor said under oath on Tuesday that he doesn't know who donates to his so-called NERD fund. Among other things, the NERD fund pays for emergency manager Kevin Orr's travel and living expenses. He's the Detroit emergency manager, of course. AFSCME attorney Sharon Levine asked the governor about the fund on behalf of public employee unions. She says they want to make sure there are no conflicts of interest in Detroit's bankruptcy proceedings. The governor has been pressed to make public the names of donors to the NERD fund. So far, he has refused. The Tigers are playing for another American League pennant. Fantastic. Three runs were enough. And later on Current State, Jeff Johns of DC Comics, DC Entertainment, the MSU alumnus, is back in East Lansing for the homecoming parade. And in Eaton Rapids, Eaton Rapids is the center of the Airstream universe this weekend. And WKAR Scott Pohl checks in with a report on that later. To start out today's show, today marks the 25th anniversary of National Coming Out Day. The day not only celebrates members of the LGBT community who publicly disclose their sexuality, but it also brings attention to the challenges still facing lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals. Here to discuss National Coming Out Day, Deanna Hurlburt, who is director of MSU's LGBT Resource Center. Hi, Deanna.
Hey, good morning.
And MSU freshman Ian Jacobs, who's here to share his coming out experience. Thanks for coming in, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
Deanna, how does the LGBT Resource Center serve the community exactly?
Yeah, I talk about our work as being twofold. One piece of what we do is helping to make sure that students who are marginalized by their sexual orientation or their gender identity in some way have a fantastic Spartan experience. The other piece of what we do is helping to make sure that all students who are part of the university community thrive here and leave the university better able to serve, live with, be a part of their communities in ways that connect with people who are diverse. Mm-hmm. So essentially better preparing the professionals and the community members in our university to fully integrate the LGBT community. A lot of it's sensitivity training, awareness training, mm-hmm. and better preparing the entire university.
Mm-hmm. You've been in your position for six years now?
Roughly.
Uh-huh. How have LGBT students who use your services, how has that population changed over the past half decade or so?
Oh, it's a great question. And it's really been remarkable, the difference. People are coming out, becoming more self-aware at younger ages. Now, I think it's important to say that I don't think that there are any more people who are lesbian, bisexual, gay, or transgender at this point in history than mm-hmm. there have ever been. Mm-hmm. I think that education and opportunity has made it more possible for more people to be self-aware and live fully actualized lives now mm-hmm. than previously.
Society would appear to be slowly changing, and the environment, would you say the environment is more hospitable to coming out experience and to public disclosure of sexuality?
Yeah, I think overall yeah. that's very true. But at the same time, with the degree of debate, all the public policy issues, the
right.
Defense of Marriage Act, and that, there's a degree to which the conversations are much more more common, more frequent, and much more ingrained in our culture. And to a certain extent, that can add a degree of stress. Silence is stressful.
Yeah.
Dialogue is stressful, too. When your identity is debated in the public sphere, that also has an impact. So I think overall things are better, but there's a different kind of stress on lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgendered individuals in this in the current state.
Ian, you are, in a sense, in the process of coming out. Why did you decide to join us and share your story with us today?
Well, I think it's really important for me to share my story because I know there are other kids who are struggling in the LGBT community with who they are and coming out and being open about themselves. And it's a very hard thing to deal with. You're kind of trapped between being who you are and being who society says you should be.
Sure.
And it's a very painful experience.
Well, we appreciate your being here today an awful lot. As of yesterday, you had still not come out to your mother. How did that conversation go?
Well, I decided if I was going to come to this interview that she needed to know. She needed to know it needed to be from me and not something she heard. So I called her and I just said, you know, there's something I've been meaning to tell you, and I'm gay, and it's something that's always been a part of me. And she said, you know, I've kind of always had that idea, and I support you and love you for who you are, and I think I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you.
For others you have told, Ian, describe the various reactions to the news.
They've all been pretty decent. For example, my grandparents, they had some time adjusting to it, just because it's very new to be out, I think, especially in their generation. But I haven't experienced any hostility personally. You know, I hear stuff in the media about certain organizations that don't accept people in the LGBT community, but I personally have never experienced anything like that.
Talk to us about your high school years. I mean, you're a freshman here at Michigan State here now. How would you describe, how did you deal with this during your high school years, and what kind of high school did you go to? I mean, were there other, did you have classmates who were out in high school, for example?
I went to a private Catholic school that was all guys. So I was never out in high school. It wasn't an option for me because the Catholic view is that homosexuality is wrong. And I knew if I did come out that many of my fellow classmen would not accept me for who I am. And there was no one out in my high school at all.
Deanna, is Ian's experience, could you describe it as typical? Is it okay?
I think Ian's experience is typical for today's young college student. At the same time, there are still stories, and very, very recently, of young folks who are coming out to their parents and then being completely shut off by their parent. There is a student that I'm very much aware of who very recently came out to their family, and within days were cut off financially. Communications were cut off, a lot of hostility from the parents, and it was absolutely devastating.
Yeah.
And it's up in the air whether or not this person is going to be able to continue at the university, someone who's very close to graduation. And there are also stories of students who I've worked with who are heterosexual allies who've become involved in student organizations because they believe in the work. And I do know of another student who's mother completely disassociated from her because of the – she didn't believe that she wasn't a gay kid. So she, as an ally, suffered the same kind of consequences that some of our LGBT kids do.
Do you have a handle, after your years of experience here, do you have a handle on roughly what the percentages are? I mean, how many families are supportive and how many really – are become estranged from their own kids?
You know, it's really hard to get solid data on that because we don't do a lot of research on young people about their identities and family responses. I would say overall responses are increasingly better.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there are still segments of communities and individuals and identities that have a harder time. For instance, Latino families, young Latino men are at the highest risk for suicidality, depression, substance abuse, and risky sexual behavior in terms of coming out to their families.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest indicator of whether or not someone's going to be okay when they come out is family acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about bullying. We almost always talk about bullying in the school context. We don't talk about bullying in the home. And that has the deepest psychological impact on young people.
We're talking with Deanna Hurlburt here on National Coming Out Day. Deanna is the director of MSU's LGBT Resource Center, and MSU freshman Ian Jacobs, who's here to share his coming out experience. This summer must have been interesting for you, this transition from high school to college. Did you think about coming out a lot this summer? Did the coming out experience begin this summer?
Well, it really began junior year of my high school experience, because I started coming out to very few select family members, and then, you know, Over the summer, a lot of my friends who didn't go to my high school knew. And then, you know, I'd heard that MSU was a very accepting community and environment, and I got here, and that's what I experienced. I've been able to come out and be myself and be comfortable with myself, and it's like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders.
Did you plan your college application based on this a notion of a more supportive environment?
It was certainly a factor in where I was going to go.
Okay, and so you felt Michigan State offered that environment?
I did,
okay.
And I agree with that now that I'm here.
What did you give an awful lot of thought to? Who I presume you did, but how much thought did you give to who you came out to and that order? And what determined that order, I guess?
Well, the first person I came out to was my aunt, and I've always been really close with my aunt, and she had always been very open about LGBT rights and equality, so I knew in my heart that she was the person to tell, and I did, and it was very good experience. My very first person I came out to was very warm for me, and that I think that's kind of what led me to do this interview today.
Mm-hmm. This is something of a watershed moment here for you. How does the future look? Does the future look differently this morning than it did yesterday morning or 48 hours ago?
Definitely, because, you know, I'm here kind of telling my coming out story, but at the same time, I'm adding to my coming out story because there are certain family members that, you know, I see only at family reunions or various times of the year that don't know I'm gay. So I'm essentially coming out now to them. Which I think is really cool. And it's in terms of society in general, I think we're definitely moving towards equality. And if you look at it, it looks like society is changing. And it's really a beautiful thing, especially for me, because it's nice to know that there are people who support me for who I am and love me mm-hmm. for who I am.
Deanna, your best bit of advice to an LGBT person here moving forward, what advice do you give most often? Do you share with most people?
The advice I give most commonly
with regard to coming out,
yeah. is to all in your own time. That there's a lot of pressure on young people to come out now because there's a much more a broader community of people who are out. Sometimes there's pressure within the LGBT community, shaming even, of those who are more closeted, which is a new cultural yeah. experience for queer kids. I think there is actually a degree of less sensitivity among LGBT folks for the coming out experience, not universally. So I say, all in your own time. You don't have to tell someone until you are ready. Mm-hmm. If you are ready, then it's incumbent on the people who are around you to pull themselves together and welcome themselves into the new era of...
Ian, anything you want to add to that?
You know, I struggled with this a lot. Just know there are people there who love you and support you for who you are. You know, they may not be there at face value, but I love you for who you are. If you're struggling with that, you know, it's something I went through and it's hard, but it gets better.
Deanna Hurlburt is director of MSU's LGBT Resource Center, and Ian Jacobs is a newly out MSU freshman. Thanks to both of you, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Comic book writer Jeff Johns did what many thought impossible. He made Aquaman cool, a feat that only a Spartan could achieve. Johns, an MSU alumnus and this year's Grand Marshal for the Homecoming Parade in East Lansing, is DC Entertainment's Chief Creative Officer. In addition to revamping Aquaman's image, Jeff has penned highly acclaimed stories featuring Superman, the Green Lantern, Teen Titans, and his childhood favorite, The Flash. Johns, who originally hails from Detroit, has also written for the TV shows Smallville and Arrow. Current State's Emmanuel Berry sat down with Johns to discuss why comic book heroes continue to survive.
The thing I love about writing comic books, and particularly writing characters that have been around forever, is that there's always untapped potential in them. And the reason these characters keep surviving and growing, and even right now, superheroes are in the media, as everyone knows, mm-hmm. more than they've ever been in television and film. And the great thing about comic books and the monthly comic book, like DC Comics, back in the pulp era, you had characters like The Shadow and Dick Tracy and The Phantom. And because they stopped publishing those comic books, they became like that Mosquito and Amber in Jurassic Park. They just froze, right? Because mm-hmm. they didn't evolve. And DC, you had a guy named Julius Schwartz in the 50s and 60s who came on and reintroduced and reinvigorated all these characters, introduced a new concept on The Flash and a new concept on Green Lantern. And then in the 80s, DC Comics had all these creators coming in and doing new takes on Superman and Batman. That's when I really got into the comics. It was in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s. And it was all these new creative voices that were taking characters that were known but giving them a new spin and showing a different side of them, making them more complex. And because those characters got the benefit of different generational voices, that's why those characters still survive and that's why they're relevant, whereas Dick Tracy isn't so relevant, right?
Yeah, not so much anymore.
Not so much anymore because it got frozen in time. And the thing that is really important to these characters and the survival of these characters into the future is different creative voices. The voices that come in and explore these characters and lend themselves to these characters is what's going to keep them relevant forever.
Does your personal life and in your background and growing up in Michigan ever make its way into your comic book?
Oh, yeah. I think I've set more characters' origins and in Detroit and the air in Michigan and then I have any other character by far. When I was on The Flash, I actually modeled Keystone City, which was the city that he lived in at the time, after Detroit, because I thought, you know, a city that is a little bit more real and the people were real, diverse, and they made cars and tires because I'm like, you know, Flash is all about movement, right?
Yeah.
So, and I like Flash because he's such a grounded character. His feet are always on the ground. That's something I always was always very conscious of, is that Superman would fly around, you know, Wonder Woman would fly around, but Flash's feet were always on the ground and that had to carry through to who he was. So, and he was fast enough where he would save somebody and stop and, you okay? Mm-hmm. Everything good? And you know, if someone he ran by someone with a flat tire, he'd stop and change it.
It's a Midwestern
attitude. Very Midwestern attitude, right? It's just kind of, very Midwestern attitude. And so that seeped into my work early on when I first took on Flash. And I still use it. I set Cyborg. I reintroduced this character, Cyborg. He was in the Teen Titans. He's in the Justice League now. And I wanted to elevate the character. And so I brought him onto the Justice League and made him a permanent fixture there. And so he's a member standing alongside Superman and Batman, and his origins from in Detroit. And you see it unfold in Detroit. And I set quite a few characters in Detroit.
In 2011, DC launched the New 52, where all the superhero titles were canceled and relaunched within the series, starting at issue number one, and then kind of wiping out the current continuity that had been up to that point. So in that process, there were some alterations with characters. What did it feel like to kind of have the freedom to, you know, take the Justice League or Shazam or the Green Lantern and start from kind of wherever you wanted?
It was, it's both daunting and also there's a responsibility to it. So when that happened, I was writing in particular Aquaman, Green Lantern, and Justice League. In the case of Green Lantern, I really didn't alter much because it was working and it had worked. I had a solid base of 7 years of storytelling that had taken the title from kind of a B-lister in DC to an A-lister with three or four other titles around it. So Green Lantern was relatively untouched. With Aquaman, it was really just a matter of, for me, going back to the very basics, the core elements of what made that character.
Yeah, you made Aquaman
great.
Cool.
Thanks. Well, he's hard to do, right?
Yeah,
and
he
so
is.
What I did was when I approached it, I had written him before as kind of a superhero, but I wanted to take a real different approach with this because it was an opportunity for people to go, maybe I'll check out Aquaman. I was writing it with an artist named Ivan Reis, who's one of the best artists in the business, and it was going to be relaunched with all these other titles like Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, and I thought, well, people will probably give it a look maybe because they know who he is, and so the opportunity for me was to really look at this character and go, the perception is all he does is talk to fish and he can swim.
he's the laughing
right?
stock.
He's a laughing stock.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to do is actually put that in the comic book because it never was. In the comic books, they'd overcompensate and he'd be really serious and grim. And I, what I wanted to do was explore, well, you know, this is a guy who grew up on land. His dad ran a lighthouse that warned ships away from the rocky shores and kind of protected them from the rough patches of land. And this kid grew up, and eventually he found out he had abilities to breathe underwater, and he was strong. And his father finally told him this ridiculous story he half believed, that his mother was from Atlantis. And when his father died, he went to the ocean to try and find Atlantis. And it took him a long, long time, but he did finally find it. And when he found it, he learned his mother was not only from Atlantis, she was the queen of Atlantis, and that he was inheriting the throne. And now he was king of Atlantis. And in all that backstory, he's like, this is not what I want. I don't feel like I'm a part of it. But they all hailed him as a king underwater. When he came on land, people saw him as a bit of a joke. And mm-hmm. so I really wanted to, in the first issue, we did a scene where he went to this fish restaurant where his dad used to take him after he stops his crime. And everyone's looking at him. It's like, you and he goes, what do you want? He goes, fish and chips. And like, you can't eat fish. And you talk to fish. And there's a whole scene where Aquaman has to deal with the perception of who he is to these people. And even though on land he's a bit of a joke, he prefers to be on land because it's his home. So by having the people in that book kind of reflect a little bit of what everyone kind of, the layman who don't read comics think, and putting it within the story and having it something he has to deal with initially – I think it connected him to more people because who hasn't felt like they've been ridiculed, right? Mm-hmm. Or made fun of or overlooked, or who hasn't felt like the underdog, who hasn't felt out of place, like an outsider? Everyone has on this planet. So suddenly he's a much more relatable character, actually. And he's more sympathetic, and he takes it, but he only takes it so much. And so when he takes out the people that need to be taken out, he just comes across as so much of a stronger character.
In the relaunch of this New 52, there was some backlash from fans who felt like, you kind of destroyed these characters and storylines that they had come back to for years. I guess, do you think that this makes the DC universe stronger? Or what's the reasoning behind it?
Well, I'm a huge fan of continuity and history, and when you read the book like Aquaman, there's a lot of the history in it that I held on to because I think it's important. So my biggest – and I understand when people – I mean, I get upset when history is reworked or wiped out. And for me, how I approach characters – I approach it just like I do everything. Like I approach Shazam like I do everything. I look at the core concept and find out, what are the immutables? What are the things that are vital to who the character is? Mm-hmm. What are the things that generation after generation in the comic books people have really grabbed onto and said, this is the essence of the character. You need to have the essence of it. And I think that's the most important thing. So for me, it was a chance for me in particular to get back to basics. And, my back to basics is holding on to the stuff that works and not changing things for the sake of change. That's how I approach each one of my books.
I think the representation of females and minorities in comics is something that is an issue across all media forms. But as a writer yourself, what are some of the things that you are trying to do or you want to do to better represent females and minority characters or represent your female minority readers in your work?
Sure. My father's Lebanese, and there's a big Lebanese community in mm-hmm. Detroit, as everyone probably knows. And so last year I actually created an Arab American character in Green Lantern, a new Arab American Green Lantern. and it got a lot of attention, and it was 90% positive, which is more than you could ever hope for. And we went down to the Arab American. I went to the Arab American Museum in Dearborn and did an event there, talked to kids, talked about the character. And really, when I created the character, there's a and I really am excited about it, but there's a very strong within DC and Warner Brothers, but there's a very strong drive to create diversity in our books, in our cast, and everything else. And so for me, working on characters like Cyborg and trying to elevate him into the Justice League, and he's a prominent character in the Justice League, or introducing a character like Simon Baz, who's I think by far the most prominent Arab American superhero out there. And really his story dealt with I wanted his story to deal with that too, because you know, post 9/11, you know, half my family is Lebanese, and there was a lot of backlash. And it gets crazy. Like, there's backlash against, I remember there was some Indian shop owner who people were like, go back to, like, they know what he, like, there's people that don't even understand.
It's very ignorant.
Yeah, it's super ignorant. And for me, I wanted to highlight the, you know, Green Lantern, the whole concept is that you get a ring because you can overcome fear. And traditionally in Green Lantern comic books, that's been about, you know, all sorts of things. A lot of physical fear, a lot of, you know, emotional fear. But what I want to do is explore cultural fear. And so I wanted to have a character who was dealing with the misperceptions of, I think, what a lot of Arab Americans dealt with. And still deal with. So that's why the character was created, and that's why his story, I think, resonated really strongly. But it's always top of mind to try and, you know, diversify and celebrate the, you know, for me, what makes America such a wonderful country is that it's every kind of culture together. That's strength is diversity. You know, I think unity is, that's going to lead to a very mundane life with unity. Homogeny. And then my first character ever actually was a character called Stargirl, who's female. And I wanted to, when I wrote her, my sister had passed away a couple years earlier, and I wanted to create a character that was inspired by her, but also a character she would read, because we used to make her read Lois Lane comics. And it's like, I wanted to create a superhero, a teenage girl superhero that teenage girls too could identify with. And that's where Stargirl came from, is my inspiration from my sister. I was approached storytelling, though, I try and do it not just from a gender or an ethnic point of view. I try and do it from just a human point of view, from a how does it feel to be alive and connect with people, you know, because I think playing on themes of like the Aquaman thing of being undervalued or being, you know, having worse perception about you or being put down, I think that's universal. That doesn't apply to a single type of person. That's just being human and alive, and that's what I really strive for in my storytelling, is just to connect emotionally these characters with feelings that are universal, and that's what I enjoy doing.
Jeff Johns is a chief creative officer of DC Entertainment and the grand marshal of MSU's homecoming parade.
Go green.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks so much for your time today.
Sure, thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, recreational vehicles come in all sorts of sizes and shapes, but of all the RVs out there, none is as easily recognizable as the Airstream, always metallic silver. An Airstream looks a lot like an airplane without wings. Now, Airstream lovers from across the country are converging on Eaton Rapids for a weekend gathering called Urban Air. Main Street will be filled with Airstreams, and visitors will be able to check them out and meet their owners. And current state Scott Pohl went to Eaton Rapids to meet some of these folks, and he's here with more on Urban Air. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Good. What can you tell us about Urban Air?
Well, when I went down there yesterday, the Airstreams were just starting to trickle into Eaton Rapids. Registration didn't start until 3 in the afternoon, but there were some there already when I went down in the morning. I'm sure Main Street is filled with Airstreams today in Eaton Rapids. They have a full slate of activities today and tomorrow, with things wrapping up on Sunday morning. Along with checking out the Airstreams, there will be live music, campfires, food, and a lot more. Let's hear from a few of the Airstreamers I met yesterday, starting with Dave Schumann. Dave is General Manager of Customer Support with Airstream.
Airstream's people getting together really started back 50-some years ago when Wally Byam, the founder of Airstream, created a club. And while this isn't a club event, it's just what people have done. They want to get together. They want to enjoy the Airstream. And this is just another great event to be able for the people to come out and get together.
What does it mean to Airstream to know that people have this kind of affection for their Airstreams and that they get together to see each other's rigs, that sort of thing? What does it mean to the company?
Well, it's fun. It's fun not just for the company itself, but the employees to see the interest that's out in the area for the Airstream product. Airstream's been built since 1931. There's sort of a cult following, if you will, but at the factory, we love these kind of events. We like to see people out getting together because that's really what Airstream is.
Tell me about modern-day Airstream, the condition of the company, where these are built. What's some of the basic information about Airstream today?
The only plant that's still open is in Jackson Center.
And where's that?
In West Central Ohio. Currently, our production has doubled in the last year. We're building 50 trailers a week. We also build a Class B van on a Mercedes Sprinter chassis, and we're building about 11 a week of those. So the last year, the economy's really picked up, and we've hired about 110 people back at the factory.
You know, during the recession, lots of businesses had hard times. The auto industry comes to mind, but recreational vehicles, one would assume, were also hard hit by the recession. Did Airstream have trouble with the recession, and how did it get through the recession?
Airstream, obviously, with its history, has been over the years up and down. I mean, it's cyclical with the economy, just like you talk. In 2007, yes, there was definitely a downturn, but we had been through those before, so we were more attuned to what we needed to do. We scaled back, we cut our overheads, and were able to weather the storm, and coming out of it now, it pretty much hit the ground running.
If I walked into a dealership today and said I wanted the top-of-the-line Airstream, describe the vehicle I would be getting.
Well, it could be two different models you're looking at. The current classic trailer, which is Corian countertops, Moen faucets, Hickory cabinets, would be the top of the line. But we recently come out with a Lanjot product that is more of fashioned after the yacht, if you will. It's got teak flooring in it. It's more upscale. And that one's going to retail between probably $140,000 and $150,000.
How many units like that would you move in a year?
Right now we have orders for probably about 70 of those. We're just starting production of that particular model.
My name's Kirk McKellar. I'm co-founder of this event, Urban Air, Wake Up Downtown.
Tell me how Urban Air came to Eaton Rapids.
Well, we were supposed to be in Rockford, Michigan a couple of years ago, and at the last minute, the plans changed, and we made a phone call to Eaton Rapids, and they called us back a week later and welcomed us with open arms, and we put the event together in 5 weeks, and they've just been wonderful to work with.
How many people were here last year, and how many are you expecting this year?
Last year we had 33 trailers, and this year we're going to be over 100.
Wow. Now, when people get here with their trailers, we're standing on Main Street in Eaton Rapids right now. Will they be parked up and down Main Street? Will they be all over town?
They're going to go to a staging area at the athletic field, and then the street is going to be closed, and then we will move them in one at a time based on obstacles such as trees and light posts and planters. And so it's kind of a highly detailed situation where we had to bring them in and work around those obstacles.
If someone doesn't own an Airstream, what are they going to see when they come to Eaton Rapids this weekend?
The people that come into downtown from outlying areas will get a chance to rediscover Eaton Rapids, and they'll get to tour the Airstreams and meet their owners, who are awfully proud of them. And we're also having a charitable event where we're decorating the trailers, and the people are going to vote on the best decorated trailers with food items that we're going to donate to the local charity Hearts and Hands.
Tell me about your own Airstream.
I own two Airstreams. They're both 1967s, and they're both in perfect working order still. And that's kind of what got me hooked.
Well, I'm Chad Carlson with Urban Air, co-founder with Kirk McKellar. Yeah, my father started Woodland Travel Center, which is located in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and we're the world's oldest dealer, actually, for Airstream, and it's just it's a love that we have. And but we've been affiliated with Airstream actually going back to the early 50s, because my grandfather with Max Bowen invented the water heater for the RV industry, and Airstream actually was the first one to take it on, because it was the first safety-regulated LP appliance.
What is it about Airstreams that people love?
I think it's that iconic fuselage shape, the love of just a unique way to travel, that minimalistic living. Some people even choose to just make that their home, and they have a million ports of call.
Tell me about the standards to which an Airstream is built and how it might differ from other RVs.
Well, a lot of people will say, oh, that's the Cadillac of the industry, but in the RV industry, there are many Cadillacs, and Airstream is a one-of-a-kind, and there's very few things in life that are really truly built to last forever, but Airstream really is, and so we refer to it really as the Rolls-Royce. Their quality standards and the amount of time that it takes to build, say, one Airstream, say, just the average size, 25 feet, they'll build any other average square box coach over 200 times to that one coach. So there's a big difference in engineering and the hand craftsmanship that goes into them.
Okay, Scott, so you spent time with these people at the Urban Air headquarters on Main Street in Eaton Rapids. Didn't you actually check out one of the Airstreams?
Well, sure I did, Mark. Now, Dave Schumann from the earlier part of that segment, the Airstream executive I talked with earlier,
yeah,
told me that managers at Airstream get to use a new model every year. The company wants them to experience what a customer would. So we walked a couple of blocks to where he had parked the 30-foot bunkhouse model that he's using this weekend.
It's only been out about a model. It's been out about a year. It'll sleep up to 8 people. It has a family that has some children they want to take along. We have a bunk above the rear bed, but there's a bedroom in the front of the trailer and a bedroom in the rear of the trailer. And then the lounge area and the dinette area also makes down into sleeping quarters for your family.
It's a pretty comfortable looking unit.
It's really a great unit. It's got a lot of room in it. It's got a big full queen bed in it. It's got refrigerator, microwave. It's actually got a wireless. So if you're, when I'm working this week, I can get wireless access. So it's really a great vehicle for getting out and enjoying the area.
Tell me about how Airstreams have evolved over the years.
Some of the changes, the Airstream trailer from when it first started, obviously, is the size. People were shorter back in the 30s. So over the years, the trailer has got taller and wider. When you're talking about some of how they're equipped, this trailer has got 3 TVs. It's got a convection microwave oven. It's got wireless. It's really changed a lot from the early days when they didn't have even the refrigerators.
All right, so if I walked into a dealership and I wanted this unit tricked out to the max, what kind of price are we talking about?
Depending whether you put solar panels, but you're probably talking $85,000 to $90,000.
Solar panels?
Yep, it's about being green. People like getting out, travel, want to be off the grid. This is a fully self-contained trailer with LP and with the batteries and the solar panel. You can be out there for a week or two at a time. You don't have to come back into the being hooked up to the electric.
Dave Schumann of Airstream with current state Scott Pohl. Urban Air is in Eaton Rapids through Sunday morning. Thanks, Scott.
Lots of fun down there in Eaton Rapids this weekend, Mark. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Coming up next week on Current State, we begin our coverage of Lansing City Council elections. We'll welcome 4th Ward candidates Chong Anna Canfora and incumbent Jessica Yorko to our show. We'll also recap MSU football, all that and more, much more, next week on Current State. Also, special thanks this morning to Kathy Zell and all the WKAR staff and volunteers who've worked tirelessly on the pledge drive this week. Thank you, Kathy and company. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR. Take care.